A very warm welcome from Invest Africa to all our amazing members and guests. I'm Chantal Carrington, newly appointed CEO of Invest Africa. I'm delighted to present to you today's Invest Africa Outlook 2024 for East Africa. This is the fifth webinar in our series of six, including West, North, South, Francophone, and Lusophone Africa. I remember how Invest Africa helped me during my days at PwC with the Africa FS Deals Roadshow in the UK. I was actually told a month ago by my Kenyan colleagues that they are still reaping the fruits of that visit with the extension of the network by connecting in person. But today, we are fortunate to not have to get on a plane, having the opportunity to connect from around the world to look at the opportunities in East Africa on this webinar. I look forward to hearing from our distinguished panel about what they see as opportunities in East Africa, in between the positive on the GDP contribution side and the challenge on the political risk side. We have Karim Ajanwala, senior partner at ALN Kenya as moderator, and he is joined by Raphael at NCBA and Chietza at Fitch. A quick reminder to join us towards the end for the Q&A. So for now, over to you, Karim.
Thank you, Chantal. Good morning, good afternoon, depending where you're dialing in from. It's my pleasure to moderate two great panelists. As Chantal said, my name is Karim Ajanwala. I'm a senior partner at ALN Kenya. My day job is mergers and acquisition work across the continent. And so I have a sort of unique view on capital flows into and out of the continent, who's investing, who's disinvesting, and so on. And interesting times. 2024 January feels very different from 2023 January. And although the East African region is the fastest growing region within Africa, we also have a number of global and regional headwinds. A multipolar world imposing itself on the world, including in East Africa, that has all sorts of consequences: public debt, inflation, FX, and the availability of FX. So it's really an honor to be joined by two great specialists. Chietza is the Global Head of Operational Risk Research and leads the South African research team at BMI, a Fitch Solutions company. Her areas of specialization are in business environment analysis, policy risk, and macro analysis, focusing on the emerging markets. She's a bit of a rock star when it comes to appearing on global news and regional news publications. Everything is a kind of who's who, Bloomberg and the rest. Raphael is chief economist and a director at NCBA, a large regional bank headquartered in Kenya. He was formerly the head of treasury and has 20 years of experience in banking, economic research, and policy, data science, and predictive analysis. So with that, I'm going to first allow each of Raphael and Chietza to just kick off with a 2 or 3 minute kind of overview. Raphael, maybe starting with you, an overview of the region and the financial markets and sort of macro developments in the region more generally, before I'll turn to Chietza.
Thank you very much, Karim, for having me. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm very pleased to be on the panel today. If you listen to Karim, I think it's more or less captured what the region looks like. So fastest growing in Africa. On average, 4.8% of output flow to about 5.2 across all four major economies in the region, including Ethiopia. But more primarily, I think it's important to point out as we commence 2024 that the outlook is mixed, because within that very strong and robust growth, there are headwinds, but more particularly stemming from the debt side. So there's a huge public debt question amidst an ongoing fiscal adjustment, actually including the monetary policy side. Be that as it may, if you take the center of gravity for the region, of course, by far still remains Kenya. And what we have up to leading indicator numbers, we are very strong results for 2023. We can safely say, if you look at the Q3 numbers, the country will obviously grow at anywhere from 5.2 to 5.4% GDP and potentially repeat the same fate in 2024, the risks, as has been outlined, notwithstanding. That growth, just like in Uganda, Tanzania, and Rwanda, is primarily steady strength on the services side, but also a very durable agriculture performance. So in Kenya, the Kenyan case particularly, we've seen part of the shock post-COVID, of course, was the drought. That has since been overtaken by events. We've seen very good performance on agriculture, and that's driving that intrinsic strength on the macros. Uganda, similarly, strength in agriculture, including construction, but also a key variant there, of course, is significant foreign direct investment targeting the oil sector. But more especially, since I have only a minute, let me point out that for Uganda, I think, it's very, very impressive macroeconomic management. So if you look at the prices, all three prices, whether inflation, interest rates, or currency, I think they've had better record with that, not much so Kenya. And then Tanzania, obviously, a similar case. Again, pointedly, the region is pretty much going to repeat similar performance. But I need to point out that, as I said, Kenya is a center of gravity. But there's a key debt question at play. So with regard to investor sort of outlook for the region, I think everyone is still very much seized of what happens in June 2024, and we'll get a chance to perhaps go a little bit in depth on that. And so far as we can see, that's going to drive the macro stability question more directly. It's important also to note that we now have a full view from the Article 4 report just released about a week ago, both for Kenya and Tanzania, and that gives a very good sense of where the countries stand. But I'll stop there and probably go more in depth. So let me let you, the rest of it also come in at this point as was asked. Thanks, Karim.
Thanks, Rafael. Just one thing before I move to Chietsa. Could you just contrast debt to GDP between Tanzania and Kenya? How different does that look?
So I think in so Kenya is north of 70%. I mean, it's and Tanzania not much so, but the debt question, the contrast there is for Kenya, it's the character of the debt. So it's not so much the outstanding public debt stock that is the issue. More particularly, it's the character of the debt. And more singularly for the Kenyan case is the external character of it. So there's a big component of foreign currency of Kenya's debt that is the issue, not much less in Tanzania and the rest of the region. And I think that's why Kenya remains topical, especially when you start thinking about international capital markets and the rate of the tightening cycle. We'll hear from the Fed momentarily, probably tomorrow. That's some of the lens in which you have to look at the Kenyan case, because the external debt service costs are significantly high on account of both the exchange reputation, but also the actual quantum of Kenya's external debt.
Thank you, Rafael. Chietsa, can I now move to you on your big money kind of macro points?
Great. Mine are very much aligned with some of the highlights that Rafael went through, but perhaps let me take a more positive and optimistic approach. We're a lot more bullish on the region, given its diverse economic bases, the reform momentum that we're seeing, the strong infrastructure project pipeline, as well as that longer term sort of telescope view of the potential sort of founded in its large youthful populations. And of course, the most competitive business environments are in Kenya, Rwanda, Tanzania, and Uganda. And if we look at the numbers, you know, our view of collective nominal GDP in East Africa this year will stand at around $483 billion, of course, led by Kenya, Tanzania, Ethiopia. But of course, looking out 5 years to 2028, because really East Africa is really about the long-term story. We expect total nominal GDP in the region to reach around $666 billion. And by 2032, Uganda is going to join Kenya, Ethiopia, and Tanzania in having that nominal GDP over $100 billion. So we're also excited about Rwanda, though from a lower base, we expect to see quite higher growth, averaging around 7% year on year over the coming 5 years. So a lot of potential in the region. But again, as Rafael has highlighted, there are some near-term risks. Of course, a lot of governments in the region are still dealing with the fiscal aftermath of the pandemic and, of course, the war in Ukraine, the aftershocks of that, higher debt servicing costs, you know, tight global financial conditions, which again is weighing on a lot of capex that we expected to be flowing in the region around this time. And of course, the global macro environment is less supportive. If you look at subdued outlooks across Europe, across mainland China, you know, the key trade and investment partners. And of course, given the strong role that agriculture plays in the region, weather risks, of course, will have a potentially negative impact on exports, on private consumption, and of course, on inflation in the event of higher food prices. Right. And this is at a time where fuel costs still remain quite elevated as well, especially compared to pre-pandemic norms. And we're seeing governments sort of contend with these risks at the same time. There's the issue of dollar shortages. If those persist over 2024, of course, this would constrain business activity and potential investor confidence in the region, weighing on the overall economic growth outlook. And of course, security challenges are a major drag, especially if you look at underperformers like Sudan, Somalia, South Sudan. But by and large, we believe that the region sets to outperform, of course, the wider sub-Saharan Africa growth print. And there's a lot more upside compared to the downside on balance.
Sure. Chetsa, I want to take you straight to a topic around the longer term position, because it sounds like you're kind of Rafael, you're with Rafael in terms of being short term, somewhere between optimistic and pessimistic, but quite positive in the medium to long term. And I know in part that's driven by demographics and human capital development, workforce planning, and so on. Could you speak a little bit about that for literally a couple of minutes?
Of course. Yeah, so huge youthful populations in the region. Of course, about a third of the sub-Saharan African population lives in East Africa. And the region's active population is increasing at a very fast pace. And of course, it's worth noting that those in that 0 to 15 age group make up about 40% of the total population within East Africa. So I think governments in the region are aware that if adequate income generating opportunities don't grow at a faster pace, this potential demographic dividend can actually turn into a demographic disaster with huge implications for regional security, stability, and of course, fiscal sustainability. But on the policy front, we're quite positive. You know, a few key jobs programs have emerged in recent years that are youth targeted, that are promoting vocational training, that are providing loans to young entrepreneurs in business, especially in countries like Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda. And there are also various women-targeted programs, right, with a focus on sustainability, with the support of the United Nations. And there's certainly a recognition among governments of the need for stronger efforts to expand not only domestic value addition, especially in core sectors like agriculture, but also building out those cross-border value chains and industrial linkages and driving expansion in the tertiary sector, you know, those labor-intensive retail, telecoms, tourism, financial services areas. And I think more importantly, the region has seen and is seeing a significant increase in business-supportive infrastructure development and an increasing focus on innovation, especially in Kenya.
Just share a couple of examples for our audience of infrastructural developments that you think are kind of landmark and have helped kind of shift the dial. Just a couple of examples.
Yeah, no, of course. I'll give two examples, in two buckets, right? On the transport and the energy side of things. So we're seeing increasing energy intensity levels across the region. When you look at the likes of Ethiopia, Tanzania, large-scale hydropower projects, and of course, green energy development, especially in the likes of Kenya, not only geothermal, but also wind power. And what's really interesting, then I have to delve into that a little bit more, is the grid infrastructure, the transmission and distribution infrastructure that's improving access to energy across the region. And that's really fundamental to moving up in terms of the value chain, in terms of value addition in various countries and across countries within the region. On the transport end, of course, increasing avenues for the movement of bulk freight, I think, is really important. With Tanzania, the likes of Kenya, becoming key freight corridors, not only in terms of road transportation, rail transportation, but also especially the expansion of port infrastructures, really starting to bring them up to be more competitive with some of the other region. And by the region, I mean the wider Africa regional port hubs. Of course, I suppose connecting all of those three is the development of special economic zones in an effort to attract a bit more FDI. Right.
Very helpful. So, Rafael, we have a nice portrayal of the potential promised land built on some of these longer term initiatives that Jets outlined. But we know that in the meantime, we have a number of issues, right, in the post-COVID world around monetary policy, around public debt, around inflation, and so on. And I just wonder whether you could spend, and of course, a number of countries have maturing international debt obligations. You alluded to this in your opening. Could you just paint a picture for us in the kind of 2024-2025 period, how you think some of these issues are likely to be dealt with and addressed by governments in the East African region?
Thank you, Karim. And I couldn't agree more with Chiesa on the long-term prospects for the region. I'm very bullish, not only for the demographics, but also what I think would be the dividends from the huge infrastructure outlay, as she was underscoring. I just need to point out, though, that some of the aftermath of that, so there's always a positive side and then the unintended consequence. Incidentally, we end up with a debt question that you've raised that I need to talk to. We have to recall that most of that infrastructure success was on the back of public finance or public debt. And so we have to deal with that adjustment as well. But more directly, Karim, so on the monetary policy side, of course, we all know that throughout 2022, inflation was, so far as we could see, intractable and reasonably high, primarily on dislocation post-COVID in the first instance, right, but also just the monetary policy response, the countercyclical response into COVID required sort of dropping of policy rates, and that led to a significant monetary spread. And so you'd had that uplift on inflation. So far as I can see for 2023, at least the second half of it, that has been dealt with adequately. So if you look at, for instance, in Uganda, inflation is very low, just well under 3%. A similar number for Tanzania. Kenya is trending towards the target of 5%. You did see November, December number drop from 6.8 to 6.6. So you can say that the policy response is bearing fruit. However, I think the question, especially for those who've joined the webinar, would be, what's the path for monetary policy going forward? Two things are important. One is, if you look at the basket that we compute CPI from for the region, but even let me use Kenya as a primary case, a big component of it is food. So you can tell the volatility therein is primarily an agriculture question, and the weather. Chiesa did point out to climate risks. So again, these things are related. That's why you need to be concerned about that. But with a target of 5% across the region, by the way, Tanzania has just changed its monetary policy framework into inflation targeting as well right now, just as at the end of last week. So everybody with a target of 5% for the region, depending on what sort of variance you provide along that, I think for most of 2024, that will be achieved. the price volatility on the oil side notwithstanding. So I don't see much more adjustments there. I think you'll recall that for Kenya, the adjustment has been very steep, 350 basis points for all of 2023. The last one, of course, being an iteration of 200 basis points. We've seen Uganda, the Bank of England, stay at 9.5. We think they'll stay there for the first half of this year. I think, as I've said, you've seen significant success on their war inflation. Tanzania has just started off at 5.5. It's a new the first time they are issuing that. And then Rwanda, of course, is also getting significant success in inflation, dropping about to 6.2. So on the monetary policy side, the adjustment is more or less complete. I do think, though, that in the short term, potentially you could see another 100 basis points movement across yield curves led by Kenya. So you'll see a significant tightening on the shorter end, not much less the longer end, which is okay. The kind of adjustment that I worry about, and I need to say this carefully, is on the fiscal side. As we all know, you pointed out, Karim, very eloquently, significant debt issues led by Kenya. So there's a €2 billion euro bond due, as I'd already said. And so far as we can see, the level of reserves, including the augmentation of the program, there will need to be a refinancing of the same. So as you did see last week, Ivory Coast was first African sovereign to return to international capital markets. I think that was a good show. So indicatively, what we are seeing, at least international capital markets, is potentially room could open for Kenya to reissue. And as far as we know, the lead arrangers are already on this. So you could see Kenya return to market pretty quickly because that seems to be the...
Rafael, sorry, just to jump in there, would that be a refinancing, you think?
Yes. Directly. Yeah. So they potentially could just issue a €2 billion note, that depending on the appetite they receive, they could go higher than that. So if they get that, then easily they pass through June 2024 because the next is 2020. Sorry.
And what do you see that doing to the rates? So what are the likely rates that one an issue like that would attract?
So we saw, and Cheza Areva can also chime in, we saw Ivory Coast, which is better credit, of course, at about 9.5. So we are thinking potentially double digit, perhaps a slightly under 10%, if at all. But I'm watching the Eurobond yields pretretty closely. So June 2024 is currently at 13.5. All right. So significant room there. But I don't see anything lower than 9%, at least if Kenya returns to the market. But anything under 10% would still be decent because the alternative is a default. And of course, that is perilous. That would have catastrophic consequences. I don't think anybody would want to see Kenya default, especially soon after Zambia and the rest of them, Ghana and what have you. So I think if we get June 2024 out of the way, if Kenya successfully crosses that event risk, then I think Chiesa's rather fairly and I think accurately optimistic tone returns more dramatically. Because so far as I see now, in the short term, everybody is evaluating the East African sovereigns from the lens of a potential Kenyan default, which, by the way, just to state it very clearly, I do not think Kenya is close to default. I think there is sufficient room for Kenya to be able to avoid a default. And when that happens, you'll then see some of those longer term trends that Chiesa was pointing to begin to stamp themselves. And I think the kind of adjustments under the program right now that are being carried is right. So consolidate fiscal balances and maintain tight monetary policy as they have done and keep keep a tab on inflation at sub 7%. I think you can deliver some sort of macroeconomic stability in the short term, and in which case then will be the next stage for growth. Yeah.
Thanks. Chiesa, just before I bring you in, I want you, Rafael, in under a minute to talk a little bit about currency. We have a very different perspective, say, for Kenya, Uganda and Tanzania on the direction of the currency. Just speak to that for literally 30 minutes with something of a forward-looking view.
Thank you, Karim. I think that is the big elephant in the room. So the Kenya shilling has depreciated north of 25% for 2023. That adjustment was expected for two reasons. If you look at the external performance, there is no question that developments in the balance of payment pointed to a re-evaluation of the Kenya shilling on a fair value basis. And if you look at the state of, for instance, US rates, there was no doubt that the Kenya shilling ought to have corrected. It doesn't help that there was a market dysfunction. This is now not controversial. At least none other than the governor of the Central Bank of Kenya has conceded as much, in which case I think there are policy missteps in trying to support the currency by his reporting. But because of the nature in which of Kenya's public debt, especially external debt, the size of it, the country got wedded into making sure that the exchange rate did not lead to debt sustainability wantonly. So what do I mean? Whenever the Kenya shilling depreciates, the debt service costs rise in leaps, all right? So you can tell why any sovereign such as Kenya would then be interested in the level of the currency. And so in cases like this, you get interference on the market microstructure question, and there was no meaningful price discovery. So in the last couple of months, at least they have gotten to try and correct that, which is why you are seeing a sharp depreciation on the currency. Now, directionally, it's still arguably, it has corrected quite a bit. So as I say, 20-25%, that's a significant adjustment. We think it's about done. Maybe just get a bit of, let's see whether the interest rate move that they pulled up in December will attract portfolio flows to begin addressing the current account sort of imbalances that we see. Strong remittances is backing that up. And then, so what I do think actually is direction for the currency, yes, south, but much less rapidly than we've seen in the past. And I would argue Uganda is actually the converse of that. So we've seen actually that strengthening because I think they were a lot freer on their capital account management than we were as Kenya. Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania are more or less on the same street, and then Uganda on a different street. So Uganda is having significant success with its currency management more directly. But I remain positive that at least the Kenya shilling had done a bit of the adjustment that was necessary. Yeah.
Thank you, Rafael. So Chietsa, I'll bring you in here now. You can hear me, I hope. Yeah?
Yes.
Great. So please chime in on anything you want to on what Rafael said. But in particular, I guess, you know, one of the ways of combating FX issues is for us to trade more with each other. Okay. And interregional trade in East Africa, I think, is currently about 13%, compares very poorly to, say, the EU. Could you talk a little bit about kind of the regional integration initiatives, what you see on the ground in terms of boosting inter-African trade, and how Kenya and I suppose Tanzania in particular are key players in this regard?
Yeah, absolutely. If I can just add a comment to the earlier discussion and the very valid points that Rafael outlined. Let's not underplay or downplay the potential risks or the potential opportunities, rather, that will come from the support of multilateral partners and multilateral lenders, be it an FX question, a debt question, and a trade question. So to your question, Karim, in terms of what's being pursued, I think there's a lot of improvement within the region on the soft infrastructure side, right, on the institutional infrastructure side of the equation within East Africa. We've already seen this, of course, with the advancement of the EAC, and we're looking at a monetary union in the near future. We've seen, of course, with the more recent AFCFTA, the Africa Continental Free Trade Area also presents some pretty big opportunity areas to enhance trade. And of course, this fundamentally creates a platform to further formalize cross-border trade, which could go a long way in helping to plug some of those additional fiscal gaps that we're seeing play out in country, of course, you know, alongside lowering tariffs and harmonizing trade procedures, reducing red tape. An important aspect of Africa's trade growth, and this was important for the EU as well, in terms of deeper intra-regional trade development, relates to integration into global value chains, right? And this has really driven trade growth in other regions, be it ASEAN or the EU or NAFTA, now known as the USMCA. So new trade deals and, of course, the growth of strategic, special economic zones tipped towards these will be quite key. Of course, we saw just last month, Kenya and the EU signed an economic partnership agreement, which really marks the first broad trade deal between the EU and an African country since, 2016. And of course, Kenya's made some progress with the US on a trade deal, and Tanzania's forging closer relations with India, for example, on a range of issues alongside, you know, sort of traditional trade deals. And for the region, of course, these close relations with China have also yielded benefits in terms of regional infrastructure development. So a lot of sort of low-hanging fruit exists there. Of course, a third component after transport and energy is really building out the infrastructure of trade finance. And we've seen strong efforts in mobilizing banks, fintech solutions, and of course, leveraging the broader support being provided by multilateral and foreign partners like the FDB, BII. So I think that's going to be really important, especially as we move closer towards sort of sustainability-linked commercial practices and lending, and sort of deals more tipped towards small and medium-sized enterprises across the region. And again, it circles back to that issue of formalization of trade flows, which should be a priority in this regard, and improves the depth of data gathering of trade knowledge, and of course lowering that risk premium in that
regard. Can I just Chietza, jump in there and ask very quickly, and just everyone a reminder, please put your questions in the chat. We have two, but please keep them going. We've got 10 minutes at the end. DRC's obviously just had an election, and it's, you know, the incumbent president was re-elected and so on. How do you see that? Just talk a little bit about DRC and how it impacts the East African region more broadly. Opportunities and threats.
Yeah, well, the DRC is particularly, it's globally important, given its significant mineral base and the kind of investment that we're seeing in its resource sectors. So, of course, we've seen efforts not only West of Africa, Lobito Corridor, but also through Tanzania to kind of build out that infrastructure that allows bulk freight flows, right, from the DRC. And of course, the DRC has recently joined the EAC. I think that's really important for the regional grouping in terms of enhancing trade and diversifying that trade base. So there are a lot of potential significant benefits there, but of course, there are political risks to consider, given sort of fractious relationships between the DRC and of course, the likes of Rwanda. But again, the regional grouping does provide a basis for a diplomatic reconciliation or diplomatic sort of reconstruction and trade-focused rebuilding of relations between the wider region and the DRC itself. But it is absolutely critical to energy of the future, to minerals of the future, to the sort of economy, the sort of tech-based economy of the future in a very global manner and in a way that can further connect the region. It can be a key outlet for the DRC, even more to global value chains.
Okay, great, wonderful. Thank you, Chietza. So we have 10 minutes for questions. So please pop them into the chat. There's one question here from Antoinette Sala, which I'll put out there, and either of you or both of you can jump in and take it. And the question is, in which sector in agriculture could attract investors? You know, where, I think the question is targeting where in the agriculture value chain do you think there's the most interest, or there should be the most interest? Chietza, do you want to give it a go? And then Rafael, you can jump in.
I can give it a rather short response. I suppose with agriculture, it's not so much sector specific, but horticulture does look interesting in terms of the kind of margins that are present there. I think the sort of tea and coffee sectors are a lot more interesting as well. So given the sort of price trajectory in the coffee space. But soft commodities wise, I think what's very interesting is the potential to attract sustainable financing towards those sort of sectors. And attract sustainable financing towards your sort of smallholder farmers within those sectors as well. I think we're also excited about the potential services areas around the agricultural sector, right? So your logistics, transport around that. We've seen the likes of Rwanda and of course Kenya invest quite significantly within that, not only in the overland transportation space, but also in the aviation space. And again, that circles back to, you know, the horticulture aspects. But yeah, but that's really what sticks out for us.
Thanks, Shetsa. Anything to add to that question, Rafael?
Thank you. There was a bit of a freeze. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes, thanks.
I was just asking whether on the agriculture value chain you wanted to add anything.
Yes, I agree. I agree with the areas Chiesa points out, but I need to remind us that if you're looking at agriculture and opportunities there too, it's important. I think Chiesa prefaced this pretty well. It's important to step out of agriculture as traditionally the direct, more traditional participants in the sector and look at it holistically. So it's, for instance, literally a quarter of the region's GDP, all right, and has significant linkages across multiple sectors, be it agro processing, which is entirely manufacturing and what have you. Despite that, the way I'd look at agricultural opportunity is what are the risks in it? I think in some of the remarks Chiesa made, she pointed to climate risks. But then it means that if 25% of the region's GDP is going to be rain-fed agriculture, then I would look at opportunities on how to cure for that. So if I'm looking at irrigation, for instance, as a pathway away from, say, the horticulture that they pointed to, is how do you make, how do you bring sustainability and more promise in the agriculture sector for the region from a participatory point of view? So I'd look at it from trying to de-risk agriculture from the rain-fed sort of reliance that it has right now to more sustainable agricultural practices as an opportunity, as an investor. That's one thing I could add to Chiesa's, I think, very fairly concrete examples.
Thanks, Rafael. And in the chat, CHC Molai has helpfully said that there's funding in South Africa and the rest of the world for high-value crops and agro-processing. So no doubt, Rafael, you can help your clients and customers identify both your money and the money of others to help in that arena. There's an interesting question from Adam Piper about renewables. Are you seeing renewables as a key focus for these countries and investment increasing or beginning to tail off given uncertainty? I think this is speaking to kind of the whole geothermal, solar, and other kind of renewables investments in the region generally.
Yes, I think certainly. And I think if you look at, for instance, Kenya, the current program has been augmented almost twice, the IMF program, I mean, and the country also did successfully request for an RSF facility, which is primarily a resilience fund facility by the fund. So a lot of emphasis is going in meeting those program targets. So the policy agreed commitments that the country has made with the IMF require us to look at renewables more directly. So I couldn't agree more with the intimation being made there in the question that you'll see a lot of focus on renewables, but broader sustainability even more widely because of the requirements and the performance criteria under the program right now. So yes, I would agree.
Yeah. Thanks, Chiesa. Maybe you could jump in on that, but also if I can just augment the question.
Yeah, if I could add to that, I think there was very strong uptake over the past decade, but yeah, well, one could get the sense that it started to tail off. And I think one major area that needs to be looked at is in the, the planning around building connections, you know, building out adequate transmission and distribution lines. We saw that with the Lake Turkana project, a huge issue, a wind farm that wasn't necessarily connected to the rest of the grid. But of course, if we look at what we have, a key projects database with high value projects across Africa and emerging markets, the East Africa Power Pool actually stands out now as the leading investor in interconnected projects. I think these will be really key in expanding renewables uptake even further. And of course, Kenya is a real bright spot in this regard. You're looking at around $2.3 billion worth of projects at planning stage or to be completed by 2026. Tanzania, also not far behind, you get around $1.9 billion worth of grid projects, just pure transmission and distribution projects. So I think that's quite interesting to look at. It's tailed off for now, but certainly over the 5 to 10 year timeframe, we're going to see increasing uptake with these interconnected projects being built up. And we understand that, of course, in individual countries, they remain in-country challenges with domestic electricity distribution, often inadequate and overstretched distribution networks at a local level are an issue at the heart of the problem, especially when you look at the likes of Ethiopia, seeing increasing uptake there, but really the ones to be excited about are Tanzania and Kenya in terms of those interconnected projects. And then that provides a basis for further renewables uptake, further green energy uptake.
So I'll come back to that in a minute. There are a couple of more questions around energy, but let me just first answer very quickly. There's a question about legal foreign exchange controls in Kenya and other restrictions and exceptions. I'm happy to deal with that. So the position in Kenya is there are no exchange controls. So in principle, there's a free repatriation and of foreign currency. I think the questions at the moment are more around availability of FX rather than any legal restrictions per se. Rafael, would you agree? If you agree with that, just nod and then we can move on.
I agree. Okay. Entirely.
Okay, great. So there are questions here about any energy access and the panelists' views on energy access and reliability, particularly for larger scale utility projects. Are we likely to see those big, 300, 500 megawatt type projects? And is there the money around for that and the requisite government support? So that's kind of one question. And then I think the second very quick one, and I see Chantel has come in, so that means we only have a minute or two left. The next one is, do you see that there's likely to be reform with the distributors, TANESCO, KPLC, and the rest as part of privatization programs? So, Rafael, 30 seconds on the second question, and Chietse, you can then take 30 seconds on the first question.
Yes. The answer is yes, 30 seconds. Right. So KPLC particularly is singled out as an SOE under the program that needs significant reform. And that is the direction that at least the policy is taking. That's what we can see. Now,
what sort of time frame are we looking at, you think?
Yes, I think to June 2024, that's what was renegotiated. That's what I've seen in the program.
Okay. So it's short order, quick. Got it. Right. Chietse, possibilities for these larger type projects?
I think, again, short answer, yes, but not now. You're looking more at the post 5 to 10 year timeframe. I think what's top of mind for investors is smaller, bankable, manageable projects. And of course, waiting to see what some of these transmission and distribution
And if you were going to
look like.
If you were going to put a megawatt on it, smaller means less than?
We're looking at around 300 megawatts at best in terms of projects, yeah.
Got it. Well, look, I think the panelists have been absolutely superb, really insightful. Thank you very much, Rafael and Chietse. I think everyone who's dialed in will have learned something interesting about the landscape here in East Africa. We'll go back better informed as they navigate what are super interesting times. So with that, my thanks to both of you, and I'll pass it back on to Chantel.